on 882 6PR. Inspiring stories for Barra and O'Day, WA's family-owned funeral directors.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories, brought to you by Barra and O'Day, doing ordinary things extraordinarily well. My guest in this episode was WA's chief scientist for 2018. He's a professor of sustainability at Curtin University and, by his own admission, a professional rat bag and stirrer, but so many other things, which we'll get into over the course of the next hour or so. So it's with great pleasure I say hello and welcome, Peter Newman.
G'day.
How are you going?
Pretty good.
Which of those titles are you most proud of, being a professional?
Probably the rat bag.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm very happy to be a professor.
Yeah.
I never thought I would be. That's quite a recognition to get. But I've had a lot of recognition lately, which probably means I'm getting old. And like the AO, Order of Australia.
Yeah.
I don't get that. You know, so you can be a rat bag for most of your life in terms of stirring things up and people don't like it. But after a while, they see you were right.
Yeah.
So you just say, oh, he needs some sort of award. So well, I've been given all kinds of stuff.
Specifically, that was for your contributions to urban design and sustainable transport, particularly related to the saving and rebuilding of Perth's rail system.
Yes, yeah. And that's a good story because it's 40 years ago when I did that.
Yeah.
And started that journey, turned me into a transport expert, and I'm now running the world's transport. That's what I say, because I'm the chair of the IPCC, the UN's climate change body.
Yep.
Chair of their committee, their chapter that we're doing on transport. So I now lead the world on transport.
You literally. Yeah, you're not overstating that.
No.
That's for real. And I suppose when you are in that field, you do annoy a lot of people. Not everyone, perhaps they either don't believe what you're saying or they don't want to believe. Or don't want to take on what you're saying.
No, when I stood up and said, you're closing the Fremantle Railway? What are you doing that for? Everybody said, oh, look, you know, you can't really compete with the car and Perth's not a railway town. It's time to close it down.
And when was this?
1979, they closed it. And I started the Friends of the Railway and said, we've got to do something about this. Now, I'd never done anything like that. I wasn't elected Fremantle councillor.
Yep.
And I felt a bit responsible that I should be doing something. So I learned on the job of what it is to be an activist and a stirrer. Yeah. I learned how you can win.
Yeah.
Especially how you use the media.
Mm.
You boys were very helpful at that time.
You're known as someone who is good talent.
Is that right?
You know, use a media phrase, which means you're a good communicator. You, if you're going to be on TV or radio about an issue like that, then you'll say something that's probably quotable.
Yes. Well, we did dramatise it. No question about that.
You played it.
Yeah, we did, and we won it, which is the best thing.
Mm.
And then I realised you could win things if you got out there and you knew you were right.
Mm.
Now, you look at Perth today, where would we be without the trains? We certainly wouldn't have Optus Oval working well.
No.
You know, it's an extraordinary thing to go to the footy here on the train and just have everybody so pleased they can get there so easily and quickly.
Yeah.
It is a delight to go on the train. I went on it this morning with my grandson.
Yeah.
And he loves it.
Yeah.
But he's only one.
Yeah.
this is a great legacy, I think.
Yeah.
But we won it. It wasn't just me by any means, but I led the charge and did a lot of the media work.
Yeah.
And we had a very big community reaction to that. And we've done ever since probably five or six elections where we've put it on the agenda and we keep winning.
Mm.
People drive this and you can change the system if you get people behind it who know what they want because it's right.
Well, in terms of our performance on a global scale, I mean, you mentioned before, you're basically like the,
the fat controller of the world. Never mind the island of Sodor.
Yeah,
I'm using language that you can use with your one-year-old grandson gets into Thomas the Tank Engine eventually here. But how do we go in Perth? Obviously, we've got things happening with new rail lines here now. But how do we go on a world scale in terms of, you know, having that as part of our transport infrastructure?
Well, we can say that we probably led the charge of what we are now calling the second rail revolution around the world, because everybody's now building railways.
Mm.
But in 1979, when we brought it back, it was very run down, the system. And like most places, their railways were all running down, but they didn't do anything about it. But ours was closed, so we had to do something.
Mm.
And that meant that we were a bit ahead of the pack. And we started electrifying the system, then extending to the north, extending to the south, into areas that people, all the experts said, it'll never work. But it did. That caught on. I was able to use my media skills, if you like, my communication skills, to help tell the rest of Australia about that, to write books about it, so America learnt about that. I took the message of the revival of Perth Rail's system around the world. And it's not as though there wasn't other things happening, because the community was demanding it. You see, in 1979 was the Second World Oil crisis, and the price of oil went up it tripled. And so everybody was worried then.
Yeah.
What do we do about this? You know, you can't just have cars and buses. So we did show that there was an alternative.
Mm.
And I was very pleased that this continues. And at every election, there's another train extension you can go for. And now we've got $8 billion in Metronet, which is extraordinary, really, to think that we just 40 years ago, we were not going to have any rail system.
Mm.
So we've gone from 7 million passengers a year to 70 million passengers a year on the train. That's as fast a turnaround as any system in the world. We've gone into a bit of a plateau on that, but that's because we didn't keep building. This new Metronet will now get us back into a rapid growth phase.
Positive growth phase, yeah. Where does this activism, and I'm not sure that the tag, as it's commonly known, necessarily fits with you, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but where does the activist come from? Can you trace it back to something in your childhood that you'd latched onto, that you thought, that's a really important cause, I want to be a part of that?
It's hard to say. I was born in Perth. I was the start of the baby boom. 3 days after the Hiroshima bomb was dropped, I was born. I just imagine my mother giving birth into that environment.
Yeah.
You know, I often think about that now. And that whole move of young parents to have kids. She had five.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a very close family, very secure family. I moved around a bit before we came back to live in Perth, but Perth was always home.
Mm.
So this was my place, and I was very proud of it. My parents always talked about it when we lived in the east, and I grew up over there. When we came back in my teens, I was very delighted to be in this special place. It was special. And when you really belong to a place, you want to make it something to be proud of. So I suppose my family helped a lot in getting a sense of security and that I could do things.
Mm.
Because I knew who I was, and I came from a background of privilege, if you like. We weren't wealthy, but we had everything that a kid would need. So I went to university, and then I found in the 60s, there was a lot of people saying, we've got to change the world.
Yep.
And then I discovered in 1970 that the world was in trouble environmentally. I did hear about greenhouse. I did hear about problems of pollution and so on. And I got involved in this environmental movement. That really formed me, because I think I then knew that I could bring science to bear on that. I could bring a sense of change that was needed from a place where I wasn't doing it for myself. Mm. I felt secure enough to say, look, I think I know what's right and wrong on this, and the pollution we're seeing is ridiculous, and we've got to fix things. And we've won a lot of battles in that environmental area. You know, everyone attacks the EPA and so on, but these guys around the world were set up in the 70s. We were one of the first to set up an EPA,
yep.
Have regulations and proper assessment of projects. We do it well. I was on the EPA for a while. I know how hard it is, but it's a terrific group. Now, that sort of thing, that gets you going. You realise you can do things and make a better world. So I've sort of just been taking one step at a time since.
I was just doing the maths then when you mentioned your birth date just after Hiroshima then.
Yep.
The 60s and 70s, being a young man and a university student, I wasn't around then. Tell us what it was being a uni student in 60s, 70s Perth. Was it,
it was
as
terrific,
wild as some
really.
Of the documentaries might suggest?
It was wild as you wanted it to be. And I wasn't of a character that was wild in terms of nightlife and things.
Yeah.
Because I was a sportsman as well.
Right.
I went to university to play cricket and football.
Yeah.
I played cricket with Rod Marsh and Donna Verarity and Tony Mann, all these superstars.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous playing cricket and football. I played for the state amateurs and I was about to get into Claremont back in the 60s when I discovered that I had a really bad back.
Right.
Because I got called up for the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And failed my medical. And the doctor said, you should not be playing football.
Is that right?
So I stopped and became a coach. And 50 years ago, we won the grand final with people like Michael Chaney in my B-grade Colts team. So I'm part of the scene here.
Yeah.
And you got a lot of that scene when you're at university.
Yeah.
A lot of good friends, a lot of networks that enable you to not only be a stirrer, but to enable you to belong here.
Yeah.
And I've belonged ever since.
Relationships you've, I'm imagining, nurtured, absolutely. But also maybe strained and challenged along the way.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny, isn't it? Because you, in the end, you do all belong here.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't, I mean, Michael Chaney in the forests, he was, you know, running Bunnings at the time and all of that when we had various amazing events to remember our grand final win when we took on the world and won in the B-grade column. But, you know, he's an amazing West Australian, Mike Chaney. Mm. I mean, that Wesfarmers thing that he did, extraordinary creative businessman. And I'm very proud to know him.
Mm.
So he was chopping down trees and we stopped it.
Mm.
That was another great victory in the environmental movement and still remains a thing of great pleasure that we stopped the logging of old growth forests.
Yeah.
But these sort of events through the years, people, you know, Mick Malthouse played a role in that when he was the coach of the Eagles. So we got ordinary people to say extraordinary things because this is a special place and we love it.
Yeah. A good opportunity now, I think, just to take a quick break. Peter Newman is our guest in this episode of Inspiring Stories on 882 6BR. Back with more soon.
You're listening to another inspiring story brought to you by Barra and O'Day. This is Inspiring Stories with Tim McMillan on 882 6BR, brought to you by Barra and O'Day.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Peter Newman, Professor of Sustainability at Curtin University, is our special guest. Let's talk a little bit more about your early academic life, though. Your study area was principally chemistry.
Yeah, I did PhD in chemistry.
Yeah.
I just
Why chemistry?
I like doing science. In reality, I was more interested in the arts, things like English and history and politics and so on. I probably would have gravitated to that. But my father was very strong. He wanted me to either be a doctor or a scientist.
Yeah.
My brother ended up being the medical side, which my father was very proud of. He was a headmaster, by the way. So, you know, you did tend to follow him. I did that. And it was very easy to play football and cricket while doing science. Mm. Because it was right next to James Oval. These things influence you. I never really was a laboratory scientist that would stay there. And when I caught the bug of environmentalism and the need to change the world, I got more and more into environmental science. So I then went overseas to study it. There was only one place in the world at that point you could study environmental science. That was in Holland, in Delft. Mm-hmm. So I went there for a year and did a qualification, that like a master's. And then I went to California and worked with Paul Ehrlich as a postdoc. Paul Ehrlich was the great academic environmentalist. He came to Australia several times. He did a Monday conference, which was like Four Corners then, except it was debate-oriented. Very inspiring guy. It was replayed five times across Australia, and that really influenced me. And I was fortunate to be able to go and work with him.
Right.
And that occurred in 1973-74 during the first oil crisis. So I was very aware of what happens to a city like in California where it ground to a halt as they suddenly were stopped getting their oil imports from the OPEC cartel. And the whole place fell apart. So I started to learn that cities needed their energy and were very dependent on it. They needed their cars. And yet, when I was in Delft, they didn't need cars.
No.
So I started to understand cities were different and could be different.
Yep.
And they are very dependent on energy. So that started me collecting data on cities.
Yeah.
So I took my scientific background and started studying cities and transport and energy. And that has been my bag ever since.
Yeah.
And I've written 20 books and 340 academic papers. Not that that means a lot these days unless you've been on social media. And fortunately, in recent times, I've got onto social media.
You?
Yeah, I had nearly 5 million hits on one little thing that went around the world about trackless trams, which I discovered in China. And that kind of coverage means that I'm still in the thick of things.
Do you like social media?
Not much, I must admit. I do it and I, you know, we do all the things to keep in touch with our family and friends. I'm on all kinds of things for that. And I love the connection it gives you, immediate connection. But I don't seek a million followers and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's not what I'm after.
Yeah. You don't want to be an influencer.
Yeah. But in the various...
not in that space anyway.
Not influencer in the sense that, you know, I can tweet something that's going to change the world. I'd prefer to write a book on it.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've been doing and getting data that nobody else had.
Yeah.
And this sort of thing is more solid than social media ever will be. But social media is an extraordinary communication device.
Yeah, absolutely.
So during some of the campaigns, like the campaign against the Row 8, which I was very much part of, because that really is a silly road, we helped to win that campaign. And that was all run through social media. And everybody connected that way. And so I can see the value in it.
So many of the things, it sounds, that really captured your imagination back in the 70s. The debates are still raging today, aren't they? Everything that you mentioned there, energy, transport, climate, environmental issues, they're still the things that dominate discussion today.
Yeah, I remember thinking when I came back from California and I was given a new job at the new Murdoch University in 1974, a lecturer in environmental science.
Mm.
It was my dream job. and I've basically been an academic ever since. But I thought, yeah, look, it'll take me a few weeks to get going on this, but we should be able to fix those things pretty quickly. You know, what you do learn is that change that's very fundamental about the transport system, about urban sprawl, about the fuel that is used, these are very much stuck in the system of how we're running our cities, and they don't change overnight.
No.
You just can't. But you keep going. And we have been changing.
And when you reflect on your mindset back then in the mid-70s, thinking, oh, where will we be by 2019? Are we where you kind of thought we might end up, or had you hoped that we'd moved further quicker?
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody is able to really think that far ahead. You like to think about having children who will grow up and be working then, which my children are. And I now think of my grandchildren. I've got three of them, and the one-year-old is the most recent. He's in Perth. So it's terrific to think about them and think that in 2050, when we have to have got rid of fossil fuels, he will still be working. In fact, in the middle of his working life. So I can
Do you think that's achievable? Do you think we will?
Well, I think it is achievable. It has to be.
Yeah.
Because, and it's a bit like some of the campaigns I've been involved in. You can't quite see it at the time, but the more you get into it, the more you see it can be. And we are starting to win on this. People like Greta, the Swedish girl who decided to stop going to school and just sit outside Parliament, and the climate emergency that she runs, she essentially says, you've got to start something. Do something. Well, I keep saying, actually, we've been in it for 20 or 30 years now, and we are beginning to win a lot of things.
Mm.
But she probably can't see it. And the
So has she been good for the cause broadly, has she been a distraction, do you think?
No, she's good for the cause.
Yep.
See, what I have learned over the years is that governments don't run the world. Industry is probably more in control, or where they invest, that's what changes the world. But the real driving force is community.
Yeah,
community runs the show. They set the values. They say what must happen.
Yeah,
it's their demands that shape the economy and then shape the government.
Yep.
And what I'm seeing is that governments and industry are now seeing they must change, and they are changing.
Yep.
But it's the community driving it. So Greta's been part of that, saying, we've got to do it faster. And I agree.
Yep. Hasn't it caused a pile-on, though, in the media? She's made herself a target. Just before we get to a break, and maybe I'll ask you more about this afterwards, ever considered or been approached for a career in politics?
Yes.
Yes. I'll ask you more about that after the break, because it doesn't surprise me that you've said yes. This is Inspiring Stories. Peter Newman is our special guest. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to another inspiring story brought to you by Barra and O'Day. This is Inspiring Stories with Tim McMillan on 882 6BR, brought to you by Barra and O'Day.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. Peter Newman, a professor of sustainability at Curtin University, and many other things, as we're finding out, is our special guest in this episode. I asked you just before the break, Peter, have you ever been approached or been tempted to get into politics? You said yes.
Yes, I did.
Can you give us the details?
Look, I can probably talk a bit more about that now. But, yeah, I was approached by John Dawkins to replace him as the member for Fremantle.
Yep.
I had been the stirrer who led the campaign, that, and he certainly supported. So I was, I did think about that. It's quite an honour, of course. But the interesting thing was I thought I could do more outside politics than inside. I do, I'm very aware of the power of politicians. But in the end, these campaigns that I've been part of, they have set the agenda. And every now and then I can go in and help the politicians. And I've done that three times. I've taken leave and worked on secondment with the politicians, basically from the premiers.
Mm.
So firstly with Brian Burke and Julian Grill and the era when they saved the railway.
Yeah.
And then with Peter Dowding,
uh-huh.
and then with Jeff Gallop.
Right.
And I did the state sustainability strategy, became a bureaucrat to sort of lead that charge. And so I've done some things in government, but in the end, I like to try and help set the agenda rather mm-hmm. than deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a special skill to deliver it.
You've got to be puppet master then.
Yeah, that's right. Geez, yeah. Yeah, and certainly civil society, the universities are part of that. They sometimes forget.
Yeah,
the media is, and churches, and unions, and all the organisations, all the NGOs, the Conservation Council, and so on. These are part of civil society, and they do help set the agenda, and they often think they don't have power, but they do
mm.
because they are able to talk about ethics and the long-term vision for their children and grandchildren. And that's their business. So I'm very proud to be part of that and have had the chance to continue to be that and be paid
mm.
Whilst being an academic.
Mm.
I mean, I've done my job as an academic and I learn from all those experiences hugely. And that brings students to me. So I've had large numbers of students working with me all the time. And that universities recognise as being a good academic. Not many can do it. They like yeah. to sit in the laboratory and do
yeah.
it. But I think I was fortunate and I learnt from those first stirring experiences
yeah.
that you can get things done.
Yeah.
And that brings hope. And I've been, I think, mainly an arbiter of hope that you can change the world.
Which is sometimes a bit lost in the discourse of today, isn't it? We've talked a little bit about social media, but it's always frustrating to me when there is a hot topic. Let's say, you know, just for argument's sake, when Greta, the 16-year-old activist from Sweden, is in the news, if you get onto Twitter, you just see this back and forth. You know, the left and the right, and you know the extreme ends of the left and right, usually just taking pot shots at each other, throwing barbs at each other. It's hard to see anything constructive out of that. And I'm, you know, it's so predictable.
Yeah.
Ultimately boring, completely futile waste of everyone's time, I think.
Yep.
Watching this go back and forth, it doesn't achieve anything. All it does is kind of it divides and it turns everyone into a you're one or the other. It's us or them. You're black and white. You're left or right. You're up and down. You know what I mean? It's just it reduces everyone down into a binary, basically.
Yes, and I do like to get on with things.
Yeah.
And I don't like that Barney. It's a bit like Brexit. I mean, why would you try and follow what's going on there? It's just games.
It's too hard.
It's impossible to follow.
Yeah.
So, and climate change is seen that way by a lot of people. But being on the inside of it,
yeah.
I do know that there is a serious issue.
Yeah.
That it is leading to major droughts and major floods and major issues that we have to deal with. But
so can I ask, when you come up against people
yeah.
who just don't want to acknowledge that, and look, this goes right to the top of the tree in Canberra, who aren't ready to acknowledge that it is even a real thing, let alone what to do about it. I mean, you can argue about, you know, whether our reaction to it is too extreme or not, but to even acknowledge that it is a thing in the first place, and not just our decision makers over there, but some of the people who are very vocal in the media. For instance,
yes, indeed.
Who call it a hoax. What do you say to those people?
Well, they'll probably look back on it and be a bit ashamed of it. But you see, I do have sympathy for them because what they are doing is saying the world can't be that stupid that we are killing the biosphere and making it impossible for a future for our grandchildren. And when environmental scientists go to the extent of saying, unless we change, that's going to happen, I can see they've got an argument. But it's not right to just leave it there because you've got to be able to tell the stories of hope at the same time and say, look, for 20 years, we have been building solar systems all over the place.
Mm.
And Perth's a classic example. We're now 30% of of households have rooftop solar. They just got out and did it, and small industry got out and made it possible to do at half the price of what you could do in America, so they haven't done it. And we have shown that you can make a city run on solar, and that's what's starting to now change that whole system. And even the train story, all of these things, they're hopeful stories. You can change the world. And if you keep changing like that, we'll survive. We will turn it around. By 2050, there will be no more fossil fuels.
So we'll be on completely renewable sources of energy.
Completely renewable.
Yeah.
And it's now imaginable. You see, we can see it. So I spend a lot of my time talking about what it will look like now, because we can imagine that future with solar on our rooftops and batteries in the community that are establishing the grid so everybody can share that solar, with electric vehicles and electric trains and trackless trams running everywhere, electric buses, all electric, all run off the sun. And industry are changing and seeing that they have to get rid of fossil fuels too, and they're getting on and doing it.
Yep.
So all of these things are the next economy. So we've got to be able to say it's not as though we're going to be all poor and grovelling around trying to be find some life in a Mad Max type world. It's not going to be like that. We are not that stupid. So we will create a more hopeful future, and our children and grandchildren will have jobs and houses and have a better city, a better city, not a worse one.
Yeah. We need to take a break again, unfortunately. Peter Newman is our special guest. This is Inspiring Stories. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to another inspiring story brought to you by Barra and O'Day. This is Inspiring Stories with Tim McMillan on 882 6PR, brought to you by Barra and O'Day.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Our special guest is Peter Newman, who is a sustainability expert in the broader sense, really. Peter, we were just talking before about the need for hope as we look forward. And it always is difficult to gaze into the crystal ball and see what's in there with any kind of real clarity. But what is it that gives you so much hope? I mean, let's talk about energy. And you talked about, you know, fossil fuels being gone by 2050, which I know some people will say, nah, they'll still be here. They're still part of the longer-term picture, perhaps the next 100 years or whatever. But certainly, you know, we'll still have them in the 30-odd years to 2050. What is it that gives you hope?
Well, I think it is a choice you have to make. You can make a choice to just grovel in despair. And it's kind of cozy in that, and there's a lot of people do that. A lot of scientists do it, and IPCC, it's hard to get people out of it. I think it is a choice. I do have a spiritual side of me. I go to church in an Anglican church, and every week I look to the week ahead and say, well, you know, what's in this? What can I achieve that you are going to give me to do? You know, it's sort of like I feel as though I can be part of a change process. And I don't, I'm not superstitious about it. I just think you need something that gives you hope from within.
Yep.
And that's how I draw that. And I certainly have hope then through my family and so on who are very close. So, yeah, you've got to make these choices and then live them out. And the hope that I see is something that I then draw into projects that I get involved in. Mm. So all the research I do these days are hope projects, which are trying to demonstrate to the world that we can do it. So the White Gum Valley project, for example, which I was in from the very start, was set up by Landcorp on a site to demonstrate what a future suburb or neighbourhood could look like. And it ticks all the boxes. It's carbon free. It is beautiful. It is affordable. It's got it's got solar on the roof, which is shared. And the whole technology of how you share solar, not just use it for your own purpose, is now worked out through that, and Gemma Green's Power Ledger group that set up how to do that through blockchain. It's very smart. Then you've got electric vehicles there plugged in and running off it.
Do you drive an electric vehicle, by the way?
I have a hybrid.
Yeah.
And I just recently put in a plug as we're renovating our house in Fremantle to take an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
And I have driven a Tesla or been in a Tesla, which is pretty amazing. And I should say Mike Hume, who took me in this, is setting up an eco-village in Wycliffe for 400 households, which will be completely solar, completely electric vehicles-based, recycling everything. And it will be a part of how we will live in the 21st century, and it will demonstrate it. That's the kind of thing we're doing, getting up and doing in Western Australia, and we can tell the world about it and be proud of it.
Yep.
So, yeah, those changes are happening. There's some parts that are not happening quickly enough.
Yeah.
But I can see how we can get rid of coal in our grid and around the world with solar, renewables, batteries and electric vehicles.
Because some of the knockers would say there is still not a single developed country in the world that is now powered entirely by renewables. I suppose Denmark might be one of the closest with their harnessing of wind.
Yeah, they're actually wrong.
I'm just playing devil's advocate for a moment. Yeah,
Bhutan, where I've just been, has entirely hydro.
Right.
Entirely. And there are some
smallish
cities
population,
like that. Population. Vancouver in Canada, for example, is entirely hydro based.
Yeah.
The weakness in that is that they're driving cars and they've got oil. So that's not renewable. The power system is.
Right.
So the quicker you can get to getting an electric vehicle running off that, the better.
Have we been pretty slow to embrace that here, do you
think? Slow to embrace electric vehicles, for sure. Norway is now 30% with electric vehicles.
Yep.
In China, there are they're getting up close to that. It's a dramatic increase there. Electric buses, they've got... The city of Shenzhen's entirely electric buses now. They've got 250 million electric bikes and scooters and these new electric skateboards. And so they're all fed off the power system. So the more renewable that gets, the more that transport system is. So I think we can do it with light vehicles. The problem is heavy vehicles.
Yeah.
What do you do about the big trucks, the ships, the planes? They're using oil and we don't have a real solution to them. Electric's not working yet. The batteries are still too heavy. Hydrogen might be the solution for them. Mm. And industry are seeing that they can use hydrogen as their thermal source, you know, like Alcoa uses natural gas to refine alumina. That could be hydrogen produced from the sun. So renewable hydrogen does have a future, and the Pilbara could be exporting renewable hydrogen as a major part of our economy in the future.
Yep.
That could be a very significant contribution. The other significant contribution we're doing, we have all the battery metals that the world needs.
Mm.
And 85% of the world's lithium goes out from our mine down at Greenbushes. We are providing the next minerals for that economy. And we'll provide them well, ethically, transparently. They'll be traceable. They'll be recyclable. That's a commitment we're now doing. So we will lead the next economy in that. But not everything can be electric. And so the hydrogen may be the solution. And I think the next 5 years will show whether that works or not.
Yeah.
And we need to be in on that one.
Yeah. I suppose, again, those who are not quite there to embrace the electric car, talk about the distances that we have here in WA and whether an electric vehicle could stand up to those demands. And you know, powering up positions along the way when you get out of the city particularly. Where is all that infrastructure going to come from?
Well, there's some now, and it's happening reasonably quickly. There's a system in Queensland that has a rapid recharge system that is made in Australia. They're exporting them all around the world now. So I think we will get more and more of them. A lot of people will just do it at home, and that's all I think I would need. Every now and then I could go down to Margaret River or something, and Mike Hume, who has this eco village in Wycliffe, he has a Tesla that he recharges at Bunbury.
Mm.
And he does it in 10 to 20 minutes, depending on how much he needs. It's a reasonably fast recharge.
Mm.
These trackless trams that I've been pushing, they are recharged at stations in 30 seconds.
So a trackless tram?
A trackless tram, yeah. They've got batteries on the roof,
yeah.
So they're electric. And they are very smart. They run with optical guidance, so they are GPS-based. So they run like a tram, but they don't have the tracks, because they're very precisely guided along a track and very quickly. So you can put in at a tenth of the price of a light rail,
mm.
the equivalent of a light rail.
Mm.
And we could become the centre of the Western world for these trackless trams, because we've discovered them, we're doing the research on them, and they're giving us one to trial here. So
right.
very soon we'll get one here and we'll do this trial with the RAC and other groups. And this will really take off, because
yeah.
it does show how we can move quickly and easily through the city down corridors, as well as having the heavy rail, the Metronet, going mm. right out to the suburbs. But the main roads need this, and they're better than a bus. The buses will feed into it, and you'll be able to quickly get around. And it's electric
yeah.
and solar, therefore,
mm.
could be running these trams. So that's the kind of future we could have. It's not hard to imagine now, and it is certainly one that we should embrace
yep.
and have hope for our grandchildren in, and to see and be proud of the fact that Perth has played a part in
yeah.
that.
What's the one thing, just to finish up here, Peter, what's the one thing or type of technology that you're most excited about for the near future?
Well, I think it's this combination of the solar battery electric mobility that can link into that. It is the breakthrough that I started to work on in when the first oil crisis came, and I said, we've got to get rid of oil because we're too dependent on it. Then it became a problem in climate change and so on. We haven't done much, but this will actually enable
yep.
us to make that transition yep. and have a better world
yep.
because of it.
You're the most sensible doomsday prepper I've ever met, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Newman, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6PR. Everyone has a story to tell. This one brought to you by Bowra and O'Day. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another WA Inspiring Story.
You're listening to another inspiring story brought to you by Bowra and O'Day.